All month long on our series, Black Queer Rising, we've been talking with activists, artists, thinkers, athletes, and changemakers. Today, we speak with the emperor of them all.
My name is Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change.
I've known Rashad for years, and he's genuinely the single most effective organizational leader I've ever had the opportunity to witness in close proximity. So we started by talking a bit about the founding of the organization he now leads, Color of Change, the nation's largest online racial justice organization, which organizes campaigns and mobilizes supporters to make tangible change in communities and systems.
Color of Change is a next generation civil rights organization, racial justice group, was founded in the aftermath of a flood, which was Hurricane Katrina. And it was caused by bad decision makers and turned into a life altering disaster by bad decision makers. Black folks literally on their roofs begging for the government to do something and left to die. And the sort of origins that root to the theory of change of Color of Change is that while folks were on their roofs begging for the government to do something, it illustrated things that people already knew: geographic segregation, generational poverty, and the ways in which structural racism undergirds all of that. But at the heart of it, no one was nervous about disappointing Black people, government, corporations, and media. And when institutions are not nervous about disappointing your community, it doesn't matter what kind of research report you have that illustrates all the facts and figures, if you don't have the power to actually channel energy behind it, or what you do in the courts if you don't have the power to implement it, and so many other sectors. And so Color of Change was built to channel those voices into strategic action, everyday people, to force institutions and decision makers to be nervous about disappointing us, to deliver consequences and rewards, and along the way, to make a more human and less hostile world for Black people, with a deep understanding that when Black people at the intersection of all experiences, when Black people win, the country moves in the right direction.
That kind of both pragmatic origin story and I think the pragmatic and strategic ways in which I watch Color of Change move and in which I hear you speak has been about being able to win victories, to actually move the ball forward, not only to produce the research reports, which is part of what you all do, but also to make those research reports actionable. So tell me about some of the moments that you think of as victories. Maybe not the one totalizing victory, but a sense of we made real progress in this space.
And so sometimes I think about, when I think about progress, I think about both the wins, but what are the type of wins that give us more power for the next win, that force decision makers to return our calls quicker, that maybe take things off the table that people thought they could previously do, raise the floor on what's acceptable, and push up the ceiling on what's possible. I think about after Donald Trump's election and so much of the landscape around power, you had corporations speaking out about Trump as he was running for election, then quickly joining his Trump Business Council. You had all sorts of new energy from white nationalist and white supremacist organizations. And we, you know, really spent time building out two campaigns. One was called Quit the Council, really pushing corporations to leave the Trump Business Council. And we would go to the companies and they would say, you know, we're, you know, on the business council for the previous administration and this administration. And we're like, you actually can't normalize the two. And to the extent that you, that if you want to be enablers, we're going to hold you accountable. We went to all of these major credit card and payment processing companies and said, if we go to white nationalist organizations and go to their website, you can actually put your PayPal number in or your credit card number in and make donations or buy paraphernalia. And we went to those companies and they said things like, you have to go to the banks. And the banks said, you have to go to the credit card companies. And the, you know, the companies that's at some point of us kind of engaging them came to us. I mean, had the Washington Post reporter call us up and say, hey, you know, Rashad, you know, I love what Color of Change does. You always give us good quotes. But, you know, like these credit card companies can't unilaterally stop processing fees for these organizations. It's really a bank question. So, you know, I understand what you're trying to do with this campaign, but they can't really do it. And so what we recognize is the reason why they couldn't do it was once again about power, about not being nervous about disappointing our community. So we worked on the back end using our infrastructure to build a platform called No Blood Money and Quit the Council, and started to engage these companies to create a paper trail around the back and forth, really sending them the list of groups that we wanted them to stop funding. And then Charlottesville happens. Mm-hmm. And over that weekend, all of my staff starts to engage and figure out how we are going to build out and go public. And we go back to PayPal and some of these other companies. And suddenly they start sending us a list of white nationalist organizations that they're going to suddenly stop processing fees for. That all of a sudden, this thing that they couldn't do the day before, they could do now. And that, I think, is in many ways how I try to think about the work of Color of Change. Is how do we change the context of the debate? How do we shift what people believe they have to do and what is possible around racial justice? Well over 100 white nationalist organizations have been cut off since that work from being able to process payments across Amex, PayPal, MasterCard, Apple Pay, Stripe. We've even had some of these white nationalist groups reach out to us to try to explain to us that they're not actually white nationalists and tell us that if we kept our campaign up, that they were going to have trouble paying their staff. And I'm like, can you say that a little closer so I can let people understand how effective we're being? But all of that to say, for us, that next set of times when we had to call these credit card companies, they responded to us much different. They responded to us quicker. They recognized that there would be consequences for how they engaged us. And so along the way, what we've constantly tried to do is build campaigns and build infrastructure that channel power and that build new power.
You're not so good at taking, no, we just can't do that as an answer, huh?
Yeah. Well, no is oftentimes that they won't do it. Right? Or they don't feel like you have the necessary power to make them do it. And, you know, whether we are operating in Silicon Valley with a whole set of unchecked power of companies that are building the tools of the future, but in so many ways dragging us into the past, whether we're dealing with the images that come out of Hollywood or the decisions that are made in corporate boardrooms or the things that happen, you know, in Washington, D.C., this is all about folks game planning out what they believe they can and have to do around racial justice, around racial equity. And they'll do just as much as they think they have to. In 2020, we saw so many performative statements from companies saying Black Lives Matter, but then thinking that that was going to be enough, thinking they could give $100,000 or even seven figures to racial justice organizations, which was nothing more than a write-off for them or an accounting error, and keep it moving. And along the way, what we're trying to do is change the rules, because we can never mistake our presence and our visibility, the awareness of our issues, for the ability to actually change the rules. And sometimes those are the written rules of policy, and other times those are the unwritten rules of culture.
Culture. In addition to all of the work that you all do on things that are sort of overtly political, public policy related, there's also work that you've been doing in Hollywood and recently in the fashion world. I've seen you all over the IG at New York Fashion Week. Talk to me about both about the fashion work, but also why it matters. I mean, you're over here taking down the white supremacist capacity to pay their staff. Why does fashion matter?
You know, we don't experience issues as people, we experience life. That the forces that hold us back are deeply interrelated. And media culture can do as much to keep and sustain the sort of policy challenges that we may have. And so when we talk about the unwritten rules, we are talking about culture, but we're also talking about all the ways in which written rules engage in culture. And so, you know, after we've been working across the culture space for years, inside of writers' rooms in Hollywood, pushing to change the depictions of and the stories that are told across corporate media, but looking at crime procedurals and TV shows. After 2020, we saw as many companies, you know, were making these statements while recognizing that the work that they had to do oftentimes was needed to be internal. We launched something called Change Hollywood, which was a roadmap that had a whole set of different pillars that really started focusing on changes that the industry could make across the content that they produce, the hiring practices that they have, the sort of the ways in which they sort of engage in the communities that they're in. And one of the tools that we started to advance and popularize was something called the Inclusion Rider. There are so many unwritten rules in the cultural spaces, whether it's fashion or Hollywood or music. But the inclusion rider is a written rule. And what it does is it holds productions and the industry accountable to actually meeting certain standards and thresholds around diversity, really actually meeting the mark to not just talk about diversity, but to land the plane, and not just in front of the camera, but behind the camera, and pushes an industry to do that work. A lot of celebrities have popularized the inclusion rider. Folks like Frances McDormand and Michael B. Jordan and others have had the inclusion rider as part of how you get them on a production. And as a result, they use their power to force these productions to do better. But what we wanted to do was get these inclusion riders instituted at the sort of system level, at the level of the actual network or the studio. And, you know, this fashion week, in working with IMG Models, Endeavor, Joan Smalls, a well-known Black model, as well as a number of Black folks in the industry, to advance something called the inclusion rider once again, and having the first ever inclusion rider driven fashion show that can show that you can leverage equity and still put on a great show and do this cultural work. What we're hoping to do is recognize that while there's been a lot of words speaking to all the changes these industries want to make, what we're trying to do is actually put action behind that words. And so our Change Hollywood, Change Music, and Change Fashion programs are our opportunity, are the work that we're putting into actually making things real in terms of these commitments. And connected with that, we've also have a program called Beyond the Statement. And Beyond the Statement is a project that actually pushes tech companies and financial sector companies to actually meet a whole set of thresholds that look a little bit different, obviously, in the cultural space, but actually speak to racial equity audits in these industries, speak to hiring, speak to the products that they are putting out in the world and the extraction that they oftentimes have created in our communities. For us, all of this is how do we leverage the power of our members, their strategic action, while also the fact that in many of these places, there are Black folks and people of color and white folks, people of all backgrounds who want these industries to do better. How do we leverage this new climate, this new opportunity to make racial justice real?
I want to go back to something you said for a moment. You talked about the crime dramas. Law and Order is rebooting. That okay by Color of Change?
So here's the thing about all of these shows. You know, crime procedural shows are going to be on TV, just like hospital shows, just like all of these different shows that look at aspects of our society. It's how these shows are produced, how they are shown. And we are obviously paying a lot of close attention to how Law and Order is coming around. You know, we've had engagement with some of the shows in that franchise, work in some of those writers' rooms, and we will have more. We will also hold advertisers and networks accountable. For us, it is not that there's never going to be shows about the criminal justice system. It's that a deep recognition that the shows that have been on the air far too often are just PR arms for a law enforcement that doesn't need PR arms, but actually needs accountability. They are doing the work that helps to further put people in harm's way. And some of the things that we learned from this big seminal report we did with the Norman Lear School at USC was not just sort of the things that we may think, you know, from seeing these shows kind of off the top of our head, but some things that were just a little bit even more nefarious. One thing that I think is important is that these shows overwhelmingly are diverse on air, right? The cast is diverse, but the writers' rooms were overwhelmingly white. I mean, if you look at these shows, you'll see way more Black judges than ever existed in the world. And I know that I sometimes joke about this and when I say that I'm not trying to take jobs away from those brothers and sisters playing those characters. But what's important to remember about that is that if a white writer's room is largely sending justice through the mouths of sort of like stately Black symbolic characters that have no backstory, what we are getting is this idea for the public that justice is being served, that the system is working, that on these TV shows, you see way more trials than ever exist in the world. You oftentimes don't see the underfunded public defender that doesn't have the resources to actually mount real defenses. You don't see the dirty police work, or if you do see dirty police work, it's framed in ways that make you think that the ends justify the means. And far more often than not, you will see Black and brown police officers doing the dirty work to even show that even they understand that you've got to sort of, you know, rough up the perp in order to make it okay. And we're sending, and TV is making a deep political statement about how communities should be treated next to advertising dollars, all while these people are saying Black Lives Matter. And so for us, we've both done the research, we are in the writers' rooms, and then we are doing the outside advocacy, all to sort of shift. Sometimes people also say to me, you know, this is just entertainment. Can't you just be happy about anything, Rashad? And I think like I'm happy about a lot of things, as you know, Melissa. But what I will say about these shows is that imagine for a second, a hospital show, a show about set in a hospital was putting out misinformation about HIV and AIDS or diabetes or COVID. Would we say that was irresponsible, or would we just say it was entertainment? I think we would probably say it was irresponsible, because this misinformation would be seen to affect society at large. And unfortunately, far too often, I think people think that this doesn't impact them. And especially people who are not Black think that this doesn't impact them. But the ways in which our justice system, our injustice system, gets to operate impacts all of us. It creates a hostile climate in our society. It makes it harder for us to get the best out of all of our people. It costs far too much money. We have 4% of the world's population in the United States and 25% of the world's incarcerated population. Jails and prisons don't need Hollywood to be their PR arm, while Hollywood tries to lecture us during awards nights from stages. And part of what we have to do, and part of what I think of 21st century racial justice work is to do that work across the cultural space, across the policy space, across the corporate space, recognizing that all of those places contribute to the hostile climate, but can also contribute to the progress that I believe we can achieve.
And my last question for you is just this. This is part of our series, Black Queer Rising. When you hear me say that, Black Queer Rising, what does it mean to you?
You know, I, growing up, did not imagine that this would be a life that I could have. I knew I was different. I knew that ways in which I was different weren't always loved or cherished or respected. I knew the feelings that I were having and the way that folks would talk, adults would talk about people who were like me with, you know, even if they were celebrated and loved, they would be an asterisk sort of next to their name. And I feel so blessed to live in the time that I'm living, where despite the challenges and barriers and sometimes the doors that don't always open up as quickly, I am able to move in ways that I would have not been able to move a generation ago, and think about all the talent, all the creativity, and all the brilliance we lost or did not able to tap into because of that. And so I am so grateful for that. But at the same time, I feel such a deep responsibility to each day wake up and recognize that the gifts that have been given to me by the people before me, who would have wanted to have it for themselves, right? This is not saying that they would be happy, you know, that I get to live it. Like, they wanted this for themselves and they didn't get to have it. And I recognize that I get to have it, and I've got to make the most out of it, and make the most out of creating the most amount of justice in this time, of winning the most change as possible, of opening up the most spaces for opportunity as possible. And I see that just as both an incredible responsibility, but in so many ways, an incredible gift. Something that I have an opportunity to do that so many folks with maybe so much more talent, so much more skill, never had the chance to.
Rashad Robinson is president of Color of Change. Thanks so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.